Yes, so in albino theory, we can look at various aspects. So, but I thought that the first thing I really want to start with is to go back to what are the motivations. And we had already have theoretical talks at the beginning of the week. So here, I'm just going to remind you what are the kind of things that these experiments are very important for. So what kind of information they can give us in terms of neutrino masses mixing. And I want to give an example in which we can draw a connection between leptogenesis and the low energy CPU-relating phase. And then I'm going to move on to kind of the more phenomenological aspects of long baseline neutrino experiments, focusing on LBNO. There was already some discussion early on, so essentially I'm going to kind of continue that discussion during my talk, kind of presenting some of the issues that were already raised. So, indeed, I think the most important reason why we are doing these experiments is because neutrino physics has told us that neutrinos have mass in a mix. As we all know, this is evidence for physics beyond the standard model. And so we have to understand where the masses come from, where the mixing comes from. And then having as much information as possible about the neutrino parameters is really what we need to do. So, the first aspect I want to highlight is what are the theoretical implications if we observe a certain type of mass hierarchy, certain values for the mixing angle, and if we find CP violation in the leptonic sector. And I've taken this table from a work from Mu Chun, who's here in the audience, so if you want further details, we can have a discussion later on this. But essentially, when we try to understand where the certain pattern of masses and mixings come from, we will have models with the textures, but most likely with family symmetries. And this will give us predictions for the mass hierarchy, for the values of the mixing angles. Theta 1-3 being quite large has really been quite a challenge for many of these models in the past couple of years. So really, if you want to try to come up with classes of models, allowed classes of models, and try to put kind of some order in our understanding of the flavor problem, what we need to know is the precision measurement of the oscillation parameters. For instance, for me, a parameter which is very important is theta 2-3, and how far this is from 45 degrees. We want to know the hierarchy, because again, that can be an important discriminator. Rabi the other day mentioned that, for instance, in most of SO10 gut models, the hierarchy is predicted to be normal, and so finding an inverted hierarchy, that could be very important to understand where neutrino masses come from. And something that in recent in the past couple of years has become very, very interesting is the study of specific patterns, but the corrections to it. Usually, most of the work which was done up to a couple of years ago was looking at patterns of the mixing, which was coming from special symmetries, discrete symmetries, for instance, which tended to have zero for theta 1-3. And now one has to explain why theta 1-3 is different from zero, and indeed quite large. And so there's been a lot of work in recent years, for instance, looking at corrections to the neutrino mixing matrix coming from the charged lepton sector. And this, for example, can give rise to correlations between the parameters, so-called sum rules. This is some very recent work done by two groups in which the value of theta 1-3 and theta 1-2 is related together with the delta phase. Now, because the oscillation parameters are well measured, then one can think of cos delta as being predicted by this type of models. And here is an example. This is the prediction for cos delta as a function of theta 1-3 for different central values of the solar mixing angle. And this is exactly the same thing. There should be some lines here which one cannot really see. But essentially, it's the same type of prediction. This is for the central value of the solar mixing angle. So in principle, if we have enough information on theta 1-2, theta 1-3, and the delta phase, we could start discriminating, for example, if this pattern is allowed or not. If we find cos delta here, then this tribal maximal as underlying pattern is not correct, and we have to look at other ones. So I think that the precision measurement of the oscillation parameters and the value of the delta phase have a very strong discriminating power when it comes to flavor symmetries. Now, the second aspect I want to point out is the importance of CP violation, a leptonic CP violation. This is one of the fundamental symmetries we have. And so, as we observed, quark CP violation, we can expect this to be broken in the lepton sector as well. If that is the case, we can relate the baryon asymmetry to what happens in the neutrino sector. I mean, Pasquale gave already a very detailed talk about leptogenesis, so I don't want to go into the details here, but there are two points that I want to stress, that there are two conditions which need to be satisfied in addition to the departure from equilibrium, which is automatically given by the expansion of the universe. And these two conditions are lepton number violation, or baryon number violation, and CNCP violation. Now, in the lepton sector, we can test both of them. Lepton number violation via neutrino is double beta decay, which would tell us the neutrinos are Majorana particles, and the CP violation with long baseline neutrino oscillation experiments, and in an ideal world with neutrino as double beta decay, although that is really very challenging. And so I want to give you one example in which there is a connection between the phase we measure in long baseline neutrino oscillation experiments and the baryon asymmetry. And I'm going to do that in the CISO type 1 model, in which we introduce a right-handed neutrino, as you all know. We couple that to the Higgs. When the Higgs gets a VEV, we have a Dirac mass term, we have a Majorana mass term, where lepton number is violated for the right-handed neutrino. We get light neutrino masses. What is important is that the Yukawa coupling controls the neutrino masses, and as well, we have, in the case of leptogenesis, so when the lightest of these neutrinos decays, then this can generate a lepton asymmetry, as Pasquale explained yesterday, because the decay rate could be faster in one channel than the conjugated one, and so at the end, one ends up with a baryon asymmetry, which depends on this different of rates of decay for the Majorana neutrino and its conjugate channel. Now, the decay rate is controlled by the Yukawa coupling. So here the question is, can I relate the CP asymmetry, which controls the baryon asymmetry, to the light Majorana masses, which depends on the same parameter? Now, so this is the question I'm going to try to answer. And if we do it, so I'm keeping CISO type 1 with three right-handed neutrinos. Now, if we just look at the number of parameters we have in the theory, we immediately concluded that the answer is that it's not a direct connection. And with this, I mean that if we measure low-energy CP violation, we cannot predict the baryon asymmetry. And the reason is this. So the CP asymmetry depends on the imaginary component of this combination of the Yukawa couplings. This is different from the combination which enters in the neutrino masses. Here you see you have a Y nu transpose Y nu, while here you have Y nu dagger. Now let's count the parameters. At high energy, at least with three right-handed neutrinos, I have three plus nine real parameters and the six phases in the Yukawa coupling. What can I measure at low energy? I can measure three real masses, three mixing angles, and three phases. So there are always three phases which are undetermined from low energy measurements. And so even if I determine all of these three phases, which is actually not possible, I can always play around with the three unmeasured ones to change the predictions for the baryon asymmetry. And so in this sense, there's not a direct connection. Now, but in my opinion, that's a too negative statement, because we are not interested in having a generic Yukawa matrix. What we are interested in, ultimately, is to be able to explain, as I mentioned before, the pattern of masses and mixing we observe, and that will require some underlying principle, maybe a discrete symmetry, maybe a continuous symmetry, some family symmetry, or some other reason which can explain us the value we observe. Now, when we have that, that will restrict the number of parameters we have in the Yukawa couplings in general in the theory. And so within the specific flavor model we have, then there will be this connection so that maybe if we measure all the parameters at low energy, maybe we can predict the baryon asymmetry. And this has already been done. There are flavor models, for example, in gap theories, etc., in which one can actually predict the baryon asymmetry and therefore test, at least test the model. But I want to make one additional step in this discussion, and I want to ask the following question. Suppose that we observe CP violation in the electronic sector. Can I conclude, at least in the framework of a generic set of models, and here I'm sticking to CISO type 1, can I conclude that a baryon asymmetry was generated in the early universe and that this baryon asymmetry could be as large as what we observe? That is different from what we have in the quark sector, because we know in that case, most likely, also a baryon asymmetry was generated, but that is by many orders of magnitude too small to account for the one we observe. And so the example I want to give you is this CISO type 1, in which I took normal hierarchical spectrum for the light neutrinos and for the heavy ones, and I take a value of the light neutrino, the lightest of the heavy neutrinos, to be in the region in which flavor effects are important. This is a key point. If the mass is heavier, so if leptogenesis happens when flavor effects are not relevant, then one can show that there are examples in which there is no connection at all. So I can have CP violation at low energy and no baryon asymmetry. If you are in the flavor set, in the flavor effects regime, this is not true. And indeed, the CP asymmetry, which then, as I already showed you, controls the baryon asymmetry, depends on the Majorana CP violating phase and the delta phase, obviously multiplied by sine theta 1,3. And so what is interesting, if I try to maximize the baryon asymmetry by taking suitable values of the unphysical and unknown parameters, the parameters which play a role only at high energy and not at low energy, what I find is that I need a large value for theta 1,3 in order to explain all of the baryon asymmetry. Now, when we wrote the paper, this seemed a very large value, but now if you compare it with the experimental value, we are exactly in the right regime. What you need is a value of the delta phase which is not too far off from maximum. And so this tells that in the context of CISO type 1 models with this hierarchical structure, but analogous consideration could be made for other cases, then the delta phase gives a contribution to the baryon asymmetry, and this contribution can be as large as what we observe. So this could be the dominant source of the baryon asymmetry. Are we going to be able to test it completely? Obviously the answer is no, because we are dealing with physics which is at a very high scale. But I think this, nevertheless, is a very important statement. So now let me come to the second part of my talk, and now I want to discuss more the phenomenological aspects of how we are going to test the mass hierarchy and CP violation. I'm going to focus on long baseline neutrino experiments, as this is the task I have been given, and Raj has already mentioned many of the aspects, so I'm going to make some additional comments on what he said. And Etam presented LBNO, so just kind of to remind you, this is a proposed beam which goes from CERN to Fiasalmi, 2,300 kilometers, uses in a phase one 24 kiloton liquid argon detector and a 750 kilowatt beam, a source at the SPS. And there's a phase two in which the detector gets increased to 70 kilotons and the beam gets increased to 2 megawatts source at the HPPS. Or one could add a Protvino beam here, which would kind of give similar results. So, and I want to focus a minute on this slide here, because there are some comments about the discussion we had before. First of all, this second oscillation maximum. So this is the number of events using this optimized beam, this red one, sorry. And you see, this is the first oscillation maximum, and here you see the second oscillation maximum. And indeed, the problem of the second oscillation maximum is the number of events, because the cross-section scales here down with energy, linearly with energy, and the backgrounds. So you see, this is the neutral current background that is a very important background as it piles up at low energies, although liquid argon detectors are the best suited to identify the two gammas which comes from a pi zero. And here you see the new tau background. So now the new tau comes because you produce in a charge current interaction a tau. The tau decays into the electron channel, and that then gets misidentified as a new E event. Clearly, you have all the new the other neutrinos which are produced in the decay, which carry away energy. Therefore, the missing PT in these events is much larger than in a new E charge current event. And so we have looked at the distributions, and therefore, and we have used that to try to reduce as much as possible this background. It's important to say that new taus can be produced only at taus from new tau interactions can be produced only at high energies. So this is an important background for LBNO, but for example, not really for LBNE, and it's completely irrelevant for T2K, T2 hyper-K. The other comment I want to make is here about the optimization of the flux. So when we discussed, what is important is to try to have as many events as possible in this low energy region, because if you start having lots of signal events here, that helps a lot in the sensitivity to CP violation. I will discuss that later on. And what you want is to try to reduce as much as possible this high energy tail, because high energy events produce taus, produce neutral current events, and so contaminate the signal that we have, so give important background. So what you want is really not to keep the number, the total number of events fixed, but to try to shift your flux towards lower energies. And this was a comment about the discussion we had before. So let me start discussing the mass hierarchy. This was already mentioned by Raj in detail. So let me just remind you that the mass hierarchy gets determined exploiting matter effects. I'm not going to go into these details, as we know that very well. In the probability that Raj already showed, this is the leading order approximation for the nu mu into nu e oscillation probability. And this is the term which dominates because theta 1,3 is relatively large. And this is where matter effects come in. This RA depends on the matter potential here, and E is the number density of electrons. So by looking at the enhancement or suppression of this probability and a change in energy as well, one can try to determine the mass hierarchy. Clearly, the longer the baseline, the stronger these effects, the easier it is to determine the mass hierarchy. So 2300, from that point of view, is excellent. I want to make a comment about an issue which has been very much discussed in the past couple of years in this community, which is the exact meaning when we say, for example, that LBNO can determine the mass hierarchy at 3 sigma. What exactly do we mean with that? First of all, we need to clarify what we mean with LBNO, because we don't really have a real experiment. We don't have events from LBNO. What we need to do is simulate experiments, making assumption on the value of the mixing angles, the setup, etc. And this presents challenges per se. Then we need to what we mean with the determination. What we mean here is that we can reject, and we can do two things. We can reject a true hypothesis, or we can accept a wrong hypothesis. And in reality, what we should do, we should require a sensitivity for both of these. We don't want to make an error of first kind. We don't want to make an error of second kind. So let's assume in my discussion that the hierarchy is normal. And then we also have to clarify what we mean with number of sigmas, because in reality, given the distribution, what we get is a confidence level. So in order to quantify these two errors, what we do? We define a test statistic, usually is a delta chi-square in this type of analysis. And then what we need to identify is a critical value, so that depending on the distribution of these test statistics, we will get a certain confidence level, 1 minus alpha. Alpha is the probability of rejecting the normal ordering when true, so 1 minus alpha will give me the probability of accepting the normal ordering when true. This is what we want. The other thing we don't want to do is to accept a wrong hierarchy. So what we need also to say, to give, is the power of the test, which is defined here again as an integral of the distribution function. In all of these experiments, typically what we do, we define a kind of chi-squared. Now, these number of events are not real events. As I already mentioned, these are simulated, taking all the assumptions about the oscillation parameters, the setup, etc. Notice that nature does that, but adds fluctuations to it. These simulations don't. And so that is a key point in interpreting the results that we have from this experiment. So when we talk about LBNO, what we talk about is an average experiment in which we don't include the statistical fluctuations that nature would include. Well, it depends on there's a subtlety because this distribution is different, because here you have one hierarchy and here you have the other one. Usually they have a similar shape and they are translated in the value of t. And if you have kind of a normally distributed situation, for example, in the case of CP violation, that is that works all fine. In the case of the mass hierarchy, and that's why all these issues arose, these distributions are not chi-square distributed. So they have kind of, in some cases, for example, especially if you have low number events like NOVA, they have strange shapes, which could be very different one from the other. And so you really have, the right way to do this is to go and do a Monte Carlo simulation of the experiment and compute the distribution, the probability distribution. This is what the people have done in the past couple of years. And so this is the sensitivity for the mass hierarchy for LBNO. Now, one could be happy with a power of 50%. So this would tell you that the experiment will reject the wrong mass ordering at, for example, 3 sigma with a probability of 50%. Now, if we want to be sure that the experiment will reject the wrong hierarchy, then you might want to go to a power which is closer to 1. So that's your own choice. My consideration on this is that when you compare different experiments, you should do it on the same footing. So either you take the median sensitivity at beta 1 minus beta equal to 50%, or you take something close to 1. It's all fine. Just be consistent in the way you are comparing the experiments. And many times statements are made which don't really kind of take this into account. Let me say, because of the very long baseline, clearly, LBNO can do very, very well on the mass hierarchy determination. So even if you wanted really nearly to 100% certainty on being able to determine the mass hierarchy, you could do that within a few years, let's say 3 years, even at 5 sigma. And one can look at comparisons between different experiments. Notice that I took off the date here because that's somehow dependent on things which are not just physics, funding, approvals, and things like that. And then for the case of LBL experiments like NOVA, LBNE, LBNO, the main elements here are the uncertainty on the delta phase and the value of theta 2, 3. For Juno, this large uncertainty, and you see it more here, is due to the energy resolution that one takes. One goes from 3.5% to 3%, and then one really loses in the capability of determining the mass hierarchy. And for atmospheric neutrino events, that experiments, that mainly depends on the value of theta 2, 3 that still we don't know with sufficient precision. This is the median sensitivity, so taking 1 minus beta equal to 50%, so you have here is your average experiment, if you want, 3 sigma and 5 sigma. And you can look in the other way around by looking at the power for fixed confidence level, for example. In this case, is 3 sigma. I would have liked to see this also for 5 sigma, but it's not available in the paper. And I like these kind of comments that Walter made at Neutrino 2014, in which he compared the different techniques. And indeed, the long baseline experiments, this is the most controlled system we can possibly have. So this is the, I would say, the most dependable of the type of experiments, at least in physics interpretation of the experiments. As I said, we don't know about these values here. The challenge is the time scale. So, for example, in the paper, I think this is 2025, but we know that LBN F4 will not start most likely before 2027. So there is an element of uncertainty there. Now, reactor experiments, that's a completely independent technique which relies on the interference. We heard the talks there. So it uses completely different physics. So that's why I think it's very interesting. There's the challenge that the energy resolution that they need indeed can be achieved. And atmospheric experiments, that's very, very interesting, again, requires energy resolution, particle ID, and angular resolution sufficiently good to really achieve these results. So we have different techniques, especially we can pursue all of them. That would be extremely interesting. How much time do I have?
5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay. So I need to go a bit faster. I want to make some comments about CP violation. First of all, that we have a vague hint towards CP violation, and this comes when we combine T2K results, which is this wiggly area in theta 1, 3, and delta, with reactor neutrino experiments. Here you have Diabay and Reno, which instead are completely insensitive to the delta phase. So this prefers kind of a value of the delta phase which is close to maximum. This would be very, very interesting for future searches. Clearly, we have to wait for further confirmation. Now, Raj already discussed how to go about measuring, finding leptonic CP violations. So one looks at neutrinos and antineutrinos and looks at the energy spectrum. This is the probability again. The key point I want to make here is that this is the term which depends on the delta phase. And if you see, this is suppressed only by 1 power theta 1, 3, but is suppressed by delta m squared 2, 1 over delta m squared 3, 1. Remember that that is roughly 0.04. So this is a subdominant term compared to the dominant term. And that's why CP violation is so hard to achieve. This term scales with 1 over the energy. So if I go to lower energies, I'm enhancing these effects. You can see it in this plot. These are the different terms. This is the atmospheric term here. This is the first oscillation maximum. This is the second oscillation maximum. And when I go and look at this term, which is this blue line, this CP interference becomes more pronounced at second oscillation maximum. That's why one tries to address that in the experiments, but I already commented on how difficult that is. And this is the plot that we already mentioned a couple of times. This shows the sensitivity to CP violation. So this is the delta chi-squared, and this is chi-squared distributed. So you just take the square root of it, and that gives you the confidence level. So this is 3 sigma. 4, this is the non-optimized LBNO. If I cut below 2.5 GV, if I remove by hand the second oscillation maximum, I lose quite significantly in terms of CP sensitivity. Now, when I optimize the beam in particular, and I increase a bit the detector from 20 to 25 kilotons fiducial volume, I can do a bit better, and here you see, well, you cannot see very well, but this is the blue, the green line is a 24 kiloton with the SPS optimized beam. So there was some significant improvement. And then exposure really is key in these results. If I can go to a 70 kiloton liquid argon detector with still the SPS beam, I can go well above the 5 sigma discovery reach for CP violation. So I don't have much time, so I want you to take away one comment from here. Now, I show all these lines. For example, this is the sensitivity to the value theta 2,3. This is the difference in sensitivity if I change the value, the error on the value on theta 1,3 from here, all the errors, and I go down with a prior theta 1,3 of 5%. So what happens is that when one shows these sensitivities, they depend a lot on the underlying assumptions, on the setup one is taking, and on the oscillation parameters that one is using. So if I use a different value of theta 2,3, a different value of the systematic errors, for instance, I will achieve a different sensitivity. So again, comparisons between facilities need to be done with special care, I think, when one tries to say one experiment is better than the other. Systematics Raj already discussed that in much more detail than I can do here, so I'm going to skip that. This is just a comparison of the different sensitivities. I'm taking only published results, not kind of things which have been optimized later on. You can draw your own conclusions, but really what you need to be careful with is read the underlying assumption before drawing any conclusions about these results. And this applies to, this is for example a comparison which was done last year between different facilities, and this is, I'm reiterating this, oscillation parameters and their errors, background and systematic errors, and assumptions of the setup are really crucial in obtaining these sensitivities. So in the last 2 minutes or 3 minutes, what I want to talk about is the precision measurement of the parameters. As I showed you earlier on in my talk, I tried to motivate that measuring with precision theta 2.3, theta 1.3, delta phase, and the theta 1.2 is going to be very important. Now, in the case of long wave baseline experiments, these have access to theta 2.3, the delta phase, and theta 1.3 is going to be measured in any way better by Diabay, most likely, unless we go to a neutrino factory. So one can look at the uncertainty on the precision with which these parameters can be measured. I'm looking here at the error on the delta phase. This is kind of a rough approximation to give an idea on what is going on by taking in vacuum the same number of neutrinos and antineutrinos events. So essentially just comparing the probability for neutrinos and antineutrinos at first oscillation maximum. But this explains this feature here. This is the uncertainty on the delta phase as a function of the true value of delta. And you see that you go from somewhere around 10 to 15 degrees if you have kind of the next generation of long baseline experiments. C2P is LBNO, at least some configuration of it. It uses a bigger detector. T2 hyper K is kind of this yellowish line. If I want the ultimate precision of this, really I need a more precise beam, a bigger detector, I need to go for a neutrino factory, and this would give you the ultimate precision on this, but right now the neutrino factory is not in the cards, but may come back at some point in the future. And this is, again, reiterates what just I said. Here you are in the first generation of, next generation of superbeams, LBNE, LBNO, and then when you go to the kind of the upgrade of such experiments or to a neutrino factory, you can go down into the 10 degrees or less for the delta phase. And the other parameter which I find very interesting is theta 2.3, and people are start putting attention on this parameter now. So this is the sensitivity, the error on sine square theta 2.3 as a function of a true value of theta 2.3, done by a recent work actually by Steven and Minakata. And you see that in general, the best sensitivity is given, the best accuracy is given by the disappearance channel, except when theta 2.3 becomes very close to maximum. What happens, you have two kind of degenerate solutions which merge together, and this gives a kind of a much worse a determination of sine squared theta 2.3. And there you can use the appearance channel, which is has a completely different dependence on sine squared theta 2.3. In particular, if you remember, the first term depended on cos squared theta 2.3. And so that will improve a bit the accuracy that one can achieve. And as I said, this, in my opinion, is very important if we're trying to understand flavor models. And one could test the sum rules that I discussed before. I'm running out of time, so I don't have too much time to talk about that. But I think this is going to be kind of the next physics goal. Now, try to really test the prediction of the different flavor models that, for example, I mentioned early on. Here I have a test for the atmospheric sum rule, a test for the solar sum rule using a superbeam experiment. Now, if you use, instead of a superbeam, you use a neutrino factory, these results actually look much better. You really need precision for doing flavor tests. And I come to my conclusions. It's not really a summary, it's more my own considerations about this field. First of all, long baseline neutrino oscillation experiments are the tool of choice, in my opinion, to, first of all, determine the CP violation in the leptonic sector. That's the only ones who can do that. But also for determining the mass ordering, because they are under very controlled conditions. And what we want is to have the determination of the mass hierarchy with different techniques, reactors and atmospherics, and then try to see if we can learn out of combining all together. There is a strong synergy between these experiments and the non-accelerator neutrino physics. For instance, if we know the mass hierarchy, this will be crucial for the prediction for neutrinizable beta decay. And one can make many other considerations of this kind. As I try to argue, the precise information on the values of the mixing angles and the values of the masses is really very important to try to understand where masses and mixing come from. And the last consideration is about lepton number violation and CP violation. These are the two key ingredients for leptogenesis. Now, if we observe both of them, I would be in favor of considering leptogenesis as the most likely option for the origin of the baryon asymmetry, even if this is not a proof, because we are dealing with physics which happen at very high scales. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Ah, yes, lots I think of I hands. Gave enough of a controversial statement.
Good.
Yeah, no, I have some comments on leptogenesis. So I agree with you when you said that even though there was a statement in the literature, actually there was a paper by Sasha Davidson et al. Saying that in the presence of high energy phases, we can't draw any conclusion on the connection between the baryon asymmetry and the Dirac phase. However, what you showed, this particular connection that is obtained within a specific set of assumptions, shows that, however, it's the CP violation that we might observe in neutrino oscillation could be sufficient. And so from this point of view, I agree with you that it should not be undermined the importance of the discovery of Dirac phase. But it should not also be overestimated, because this formula, maybe you can go back.
Yes. Sure, there are many assumptions.
It should be said that it's obtained under a very specific set of hypotheses where the CP violation from high energy phases is zero, and so you are left only with the CP violation from low energy phases. That theoretically is difficult to justify. In some models, there are some very small regions, and we found with Steve King in two red neutrino models, some small region where this is realized. But typically, it's difficult to suppress the contribution from high energy phases. Yes, exactly.
Well, the additional contributions which depend on F of R here is real. If R has a conimaginary component,
there are terms that are dominant. Indeed, the lower
but
the lower bound in general.
Dominant, right?
Indeed, the lower bound.
If this already gives you the amount you observe,
I agree with you, but you can't say that the statement in your conclusion, you can't say that observation of delta is in any case almost a proof of leptogenesis, because you have another condition that is M1 about 5 × 10^11 GV that you don't know if it's realized or not. And by the way, concerning this condition, you should be also aware that recently, after 2006, there are works that say that at that value of M1 maybe. Much likely, we are still in the unflavored regime. And so probably you need... Let me finish.
I give you 1 minute,
yes,
and then we're going to move on to the next question.
Well, with Georg, we showed that the transition value is 5 × 10^11 GV, indeed. But here you have to be in the full flavor regime, and this is reached, and there are recent works by Garbrecht and collaborators, probably a much lower value of M1.
Clearly this is a conversation that will continue over lunch. Next question. Tom.
Sylvie, on your penultimate slide, next to last slide, you showed something called some rule that related delta to the mixing angles. You didn't have time to explain that. Could you tell me the origin of this?
Yes, so, well, this is the atmospheric sum rule. This comes in, for instance, if you choose a specific breakings of the flavor symmetry. So if you start from a generic group, and then for like A4, S4, whatever group you like, and then you break that, leaving an invariant symmetry in the lepton and in the charged lepton in the neutrino sector, then some relations can emerge. Actually, Danny has done some pioneering work there with Alexei Smirnov on that, using Van Dyke groups, etc. So in some of these examples, relations between the atmospheric mixing angle and theta 13 and cos delta can emerge. For example, in S4 or A5, you can end up having lambda equal to 1. In A4, you typically end up having lambda equal to minus 0.5. That requires a specific breaking of the discrete group. But they are very interesting relations. The sum rule, instead, this emerges when you consider that you have a pattern, like tri-bimaximal mixing, bimaximal mixing, etc. And now you perturb it. You need to generate theta 13. And so you're assuming that theta 13 comes in from the corrections from the charged lepton sector in a kind of gut-inspired scenario. So somehow your charged lepton sector must feel some of the down-type quark mixing. And so you end up having these type of relations between, this is a prediction really for cos delta and as a function of theta 1 2. For tribal maximal mixing, for example, you have theta 1 2 sine theta 1 2 equal to 1 over the square root of 3.
Is that particular sum rule explained in one of the papers referenced there?
Yes. So, well, no, it's better before. These are explained in this paper here, and Sergei has, which I showed also, similar results. So there's a bit of a discussion going on.
Is this going to be like the top quark mass? It's going to be space filling. All cos deltas will be predicted, and in the end.
No, not really. I mean, because all the oscillation parameters are already quite well known, so you don't really have a lot of freedom. Now, if you think theta 13 is quite large volume, so for instance, for bimaximal mixing, it's going to be very difficult to achieve it in this way. I don't have a plot, but what you can show is that the correction that you need to theta 13 in order to also explain theta 13 and be not too far off from maximum for theta 23 doesn't really match. And so this is in the case of tri-bimaximal mixing. These are similar results obtained by Sergei in his recent paper. They've come out one day apart, I think, or something like that.
Thank you.
So this is why we need precision measurements of all the mixing angles.
Any other questions from the audience?
Okay, let's go to Paige. Why don't you show me the curve that you wanted to show me before? I had another question. The one about what happens to CP if you cut it off at 2.5.
Oh, yes.
I don't remember what page it was on.
Where is it? Must be here. Is that one.
Okay, so what happens if you put it on the curve where you've optimized the beam?
Well, the optimization of the beam, I would think that it is more important because the beam is really optimized as much as possible at low energy. So if
that's why it's interesting to be on the optimized beam, because, you know, the question you're really asking is what it changes to the fraction of delta CP as you have when you make the cut and not make the cut.
Yes. Okay. Fine. So, but you see, the red one is the optimized beam, and the black one is the one which was used prior to that. So it tries to have more events at low energy. So it will be a bit more important.
Wouldn't you really want the blue beam?
But the blue beam doesn't really give the best CP sensitivity because, I mean, this region is also important, and then kind of this rise here gives also a lot of information. So we looked at the sensitivity to CP violation in this case. It's a bit worse than, not very, but a bit worse than this red curve here. Also, this determines much better the other parameters. So, for example, the impact of theta 23. So, I mean, putting everything together, this is the best, turned out to be the best optimization.
Okay. Any other questions from the audience? All right, I have another question. We have time.
And I want to make a comment also.
Okay. The curve that you had for how the precision of determining the mass hierarchy varies,
fluctuates.
The precision.
It was nearby this.
The mass. Okay, mass hierarchy, mass here. This one.
This one, yeah. So remind me for LBNO what exposure you need to do CP violation.
I think, CP violation, you need to be...
Okay, so it's way off to the right. Okay.
This is 2 years, basically, kind of. So, you know, you need more than that. You need 10 years and still.
Okay. I don't remember how much...
It's in one of
so
the...
So delivers, but okay, fine. So it's 2 years, you say.
So here you have 1.5 e 10 to the 20, which should be roughly 1 year. So.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Short comment, Sergey.
Can you show this, leptogenesis lower limit on sine theta 1.3 sine delta, just to avoid any confusion? This is obtained under the assumption that the only CP violation that is involved in the generation of baryon asymmetry comes from the phase delta. So any other phases are set to CP conserving values. And it is a necessary condition that in this case you can generate the observed baryon asymmetry. So if you had a product of sine theta 1.3 sine delta smaller than that value, if you prove that it is smaller, you forget about it. It's impossible. Now, comment about Pasquale's comments. There was a paper in which the contribution to both high energy and low energy phases have been studied simultaneously. And there are situations where it is impossible to reproduce the observed baryon asymmetry without a contribution coming from the low energy phases. And this was a completely general study, which didn't involve modeling or anything like that. So I wouldn't say that, how should I put it? There are cases which actually are controlled by low energy data in which this situation is realized. This is my comment.
So.
Yes, but you get 30 seconds. You already have, I've taken time out of your talk. You already had a good speak. You get 30 seconds.
No, I mean, I agree.
Use the microphone.
I started to say that indeed, in my opinion, the paper by Davidson et al. Was undermining the possibility, the role of low energy phases. What I'm saying is that this specific scenario, if you don't use density matrix equation, it falls just right in the transition regime from unflavored to two flavored. And it's difficult to draw a definite conclusion. This is because nobody has done yet the calculation with density matrix equation. This is my point.
Okay.
So I want to finish on a positive note on this. I think, there is a bit of wiggle room in the sense that you have, not a lot, but a factor of 1 point something coming from, if you have actually maximum CP violation, so you could absorb, you could go a little bit lower in the mass of N1. But I don't want to go into these technicalities. What I think is important is that it's clear that we cannot prove leptogenesis because we are talking about physics, which happens at very, very high energy scales. But I think what is important is that we have an example, modulus these things that should be checked, but we have an example in which this can be the dominant source of the baryon asymmetry. This cannot be said, for example, from quark CP violation or SUSY models.
Okay.
So that's it. I think I try to be non-controversial.
I'm sorry. The organizers of the conference didn't expect this conversation to go on and on. Okay, so we have to cut this off, but I hope we will continue it during lunchtime. So let's thank Sylvia once again. Our next speaker is Milan Dewan, who's going to tell us about long baseline neutrino experiment status and opportunities, and obviously he's been spending a lot of time taking pictures.